Hi everyone, and welcome back to another one of my gramophone shows. Last time, almost by accident, the show turned out to be an all-British affair. This time, on purpose, it's a USA program. Having said that, you may be surprised by the first artist because she was born in Poland. But when you think of what the USA was, and indeed is, it's a collection of immigrant communities. And of course, in the 19th century, they were only too pleased to have as many people from Europe immigrate and, as it were, give them culture, as they would have seen it, because at that time there wasn't really an American culture of its own. Even the folk songs had come from Scotland and Ireland, etc., etc. Well, Marcella Sembrich, born in 1858, at one point moved to the USA and she became a star of the Metropolitan Opera House. She was born, if I can pronounce this properly, Prashedi Marcelin Kochanska. And you can understand therefore why she changed her name to Marcella Sembrich, because it was somewhat easier to negotiate. She was born in a little village in Poland and her father was a teacher in a village. It was called Wisniewski. If I can pronounce that properly, I've probably got it all wrong. And she went to the nearby Lemberg Conservatory of Music at 11, so she was obviously a bit of a child prodigy. She first learnt piano and violin, and throughout her career, she was able at any time to produce a one-woman concert of amazing versatility, because she was equally adept on violin and piano, and could have made a concert career on either of those two instruments. But added to which, she had this wonderful skill as a soprano. And she studied first of all with a bass called Viktor von Rokitansky, wonderful name. And then she went to Milan and studied with both the younger and elder Lamperti, who were noted teachers of their day. She made her debut in 1877. So you see, she's really a 19th century singer. But at the age of 50, when this recording was made, she was still at her peak. You never ever get the feeling it's even possible for her to be out of tune. It's as if her voice were fretted like a guitar. She just hits that note bang on every time. If there's anything lacking, there's possibly a little lack of passion, because she almost sings like the instrumentalist she was. She's a real musician when she sings. The voice is probably darker than it appears on these earlier recordings, because the horn couldn't always capture the sound, particularly of high sopranos. I always feel they were the worst done by the early horn recording. Nevertheless, she's absolutely superb. So here she is, as I say, in 1908, and she's singing one of the great war horses of what we might call the coloratura repertoire. It's called Ulice di Quest'Anima from Linda di Chamonix by Donizetti, recorded on the 2nd of November 1908, over 100 years ago, but as fresh as if it were sung yesterday. I give you, ladies and gentlemen, Marcella Sembrich. Oh, Marcella Sembrich, the great dramatic coloratura soprano. Incidentally, she must have been a very inquisitive, intelligent woman. She was one of the first people to take a real interest in recording on this new medium of the gramophone, and indeed the phonograph too. The phonograph and the gramophone. The phonograph was cylinder recordings, and the gramophone was disc recordings, which came 10 years later in terms of being invented. They were, in a sense, the internet of their day, and this was the wonderful new miracle. Nobody before this could have had their voice recorded. This is absolutely cutting-edge technology. And she was one of the first serious classical musicians to take an interest in being heard. And she recorded for Bettini, who was an Italian who had a studio in New York, and he was trying out recordings. She recorded Mapleson cylinders live on stage at the Metropolitan Opera. This again when she was approaching 50 years old. She wasn't a young woman, but she retained all the interest of youth. Incidentally, when she gradually retired, which was pretty much by 1917 or so, she spent the rest of her life as a vocal teacher, and she became the director of the vocal departments at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia and the famous Juilliard School in New York. And she taught famous sopranos who recorded later, Huda Lashanska, Dussolina Giannini, and Quina Mario, plus a soprano which I'm going to play a track for you later on in this program. Now, as I said, America was very welcoming to Europeans who were bringing over culture, but if that was so, they were at the very best tolerant of the culture which was provided by America's indigenous population, the people who used to be known as Red Indians, but that's no longer PC. They were sort of ignored. And as for the black population, which were basically slaves until very late on, they were looked down on altogether and either laughed at as being simple, harmless, stupid people, or were the recipient of actual racial hatred, as we know to this day, very sadly. So here, by contrast, is the way the early phonograph treated black music. And the first black music to be of interest to the population at large was, of course, ragtime. And as I say, black people were regarded as being simple people, not very bright, and who were just going to laugh and sing and that sort of thing. Hence the non-PC introduction to the following record. I don't know who the Peerless Orchestra was, but my guess is that they were white people pretending to be black. And this was an early Edison cylinder recorded around the turn of the century, that is around 1900. And the name of the track is My Ragtime Baby.
Thank you.
A little bit of ragtime there for you, played by the Peerless Orchestra. I'll look them up, see if I can find out who they are. Black music, of course, became the cornerstone of American musical culture. And not only American culture, but it's sort of taken over the world in one form or another. From jazz, through soul music, to, well, everything. R&B, the lot. And of course, the towering genius of black music of any time was the great Edward Kennedy Ellington. Duke Ellington. Now, here's a little story about him. I knew towards the end of her life a lady called Renee Diamond, who was a very, very close friend of Duke's over, 25 years at least. One of the few women in his life with whom he didn't have an affair, because he met her when she was about 13 or 14. Didn't come back to London for another 13 years due to a musicians' union ban, and by that time she was married, and they had a strange relationship. It was like a parent and child, but sometimes the parent and child would switch, and she would be mothering him instead of the other way around, as it were. Nevertheless, they were very close. Now, Renee told me that Duke was in her flat, and she and her husband, Leslie, were entertaining him, and they played him, this is in the late 40s, they played him a recording of his own band, Before the War. Now, most people will say that Duke's possibly most creative period of all, and there were many, was that band of the 1940s. So what he said was very interesting. They put on the record that I'm about to play, and his response was, "My, did my band ever sound as good as that?" Considering he was saying this in the mid to late 40s, when he had one of the best bands he ever had, well, one wonders. The trouble with Duke Ellington is that you can't always trust what he says, because he would say things quite often just to please the person that he was with, particularly if she were an attractive young lady, and so you can't always take his words at face value. But let's assume for a second that he meant what he said that day. Let's listen to this great recording of one of his flag-waving dance tracks called Merry-Go-Round. Now, there are two 1930 recordings of this. One on the 15th of February 1933, and the second the 30th of April 1935, when it was more bedded in and the swing is more, shall we say, relaxed. Nevertheless, I'm going to go for the earlier one, because it's just that little bit more exciting. He features all his main soloists. Now, the theme of Merry-Go-Round only lasts about a minute, and the rest of the track is really nothing but a series of orchestrated blues choruses. And you might say, well, there's nothing fantastic about that. But that's just as ridiculous as saying, I'm not interested in Shakespeare because he took his stories out of somebody else's book. It's what was done with those stories that makes Shakespeare great. And the same way, it's what's done with the blues choruses that makes Duke completely unique and wonderful. So, here we go with Merry-Go-Round, recorded, as I said, on the 15th of February, 1933. It's a 2-4 swing rather than the 4-4 swing that we're used to in later jazz, and it's just wonderful. Here it is. Thank you. the great Duke Ellington. Now, around the same period, the 30s and the 40s, this was what was often regarded in the USA as the golden era of radio. There wasn't TV yet, so all the top stars fought to have their own show on the radio, and they did so if a sponsor would take them on, because they thought it would help sell their product. They didn't have the BBC, everything was commercial. One of the people who always seemed to have a show was Bing Crosby, and he was perfect because not only was he a wonderful singer, but he was a pretty dab hand at comedy, as you're about to hear. Now, when these radio shows went out, because of the time difference all over the United States, the radio companies made copies on what were called transcription discs, 16-inch records, which are all over the place. You can get lots of them, and there's always fantastically interesting stuff on them, because usually this is stuff that wasn't available in any other form. It quite often went out on air live, and it wasn't the same, even if they played some music, as the normal issued 78 that you could buy in the shops. In this case, however, I'm going to give you a comedy sketch, which remarkably hasn't dated that much at all, and it's not surprising, because Bing Crosby's guest on this particular day was Groucho Marx.
Applause, please. I'm not here as an actor. I'm here as a barrister. Mm-hmm. My card, Crosby. Read it and give it back. I don't want to spoil the deck.
Hey, quite a law firm you have here. Mulholland, Crenshaw, Adams, Fairfax, Wilshire, and La Cienega. Where do you come in?
Between Melrose and Franklin on the streetcar.
Where's your office?
On the streetcar I came up here on. And if you think having a motorman for a secretary is any fun, you just try it sometime. Couldn't even get him to take off his gloves. Now, let's get down to business, Crosby. My client, Miss Wartcrunchel, is suing you for $50,000.
Now, wait a minute.
All right, we'll settle for $40,000.
$40,000?
If you haven't got it on you, I have the wrong Crosby, and I understand there is a wrong Crosby.
104% right. You must mean Brother Everett, but Groucho...
I don't mean Gummo.
Before I part with this kind of tin, don't you think it would be... all right, or would you consider me impertinent? Would you? This is quite a word here. Impertinent.
You want to shorten it down and try a different way?
I'm doing a small Durante on this word. Would I be impertinent if I ask you why?
Very well, but only one question to a defendant. That took care of my answer. Now answer this. Now answer this question. Did you or did you not drive recklessly down Hollywood Boulevard on your way to the studio this afternoon?
No, I drove very cautiously down Sunset.
42 paid witnesses can't be wrong. You came down Hollywood Boulevard, and when you turned onto Vine Street, you splashed mud all over my client.
Mud? Where would you get mud on Vine Street?
I get it from a fellow who's got a dirty mind. Never mind where I get my mud, and you were driving recklessly.
What was I driving?
It was either a Cadillac convertible or a Philco console. But that's not important.
You don't know my sponsor.
I don't know any sponsor, and if I did, I'd have a show of my own. Phil Harris has two shows. What have I got? An office on a streetcar and a bucket full of mud.
I don't want to get entangled in any litigation here, so produce your client. If she can identify me, I'll be glad to make reparations. But frankly, I don't think she has a leg to stand on.
Frankly, I don't know. I've never seen her in a short dress. Oh, Miss Crunchwattle.
The name?
Get down.
The name is Wart Crunchel, Mr. Giesler.
Did you tell her you were Jerry Giesler?
Get a much bigger fee that way, yeah? And if you keep your mouth shut and pay off, I'll split it with you, Crosby. Now, Miss Wartcrunchel, what's your first name?
Lana.
Lana? Lana, what hollow mockery. Is Crosby here the man who splashed you?
Yes, that's the man. He was wearing a gray Homburg hat, a frock coat, an ascot tie, striped trousers, and spats.
Boy, have you got the wrong man.
Don't be too sure. Now, Lana, when this man passed you in his car, was he also wearing a diamond stick pin?
I'm not sure about that time. If you remember, you hit me in the face with the mud.
This entire case is a fraud. If I were wearing a frock coat and spats on Vine Street, I'd have them on now, wouldn't I?
Not necessarily. I was wearing a nightgown last night, but I haven't got it on now.
It's a matter of opinion.
You threw your suit away so you couldn't be identified.
I did not.
Then why are you standing there in your underwear?
Not...
It's not my underwear. I bought it from Ma Perkins.
Must be mighty breezy right now around the old gal, huh?
Wait a minute. You can't even prove that this girl was standing on the corner.
Not only can I prove that she was standing there, but I'll prove that she was stamping her feet.
What is she stamping her feet for?
She was sending them to Sears Roebuck to get a new pair of shoes. How we fought over that joke, huh?
Wish that'd have won. If you'll dismiss the whole thing, I'll be glad to buy a new dress for this charming young lady.
Charming young lady? I'll lay you 8 to 5. She's none of the three.
What about my damages?
You've got enough damages. What you need is repairs.
All right, then. Shall we say $45, Groucho?
$45? That won't even keep me in saddle soap for my briefcase. Crosby, between you and Mother Nature, you have ruined this young girl's life. Huh? And this girl is an Ingrid Bergman by a long shot. And speaking of long shots, Lanner, I'm afraid you'll never make the bridal path.
Well, what about Lionel?
Lionel? Who's he?
The man she was betrothed to, she was going to marry this afternoon.
Ah, the plot thickens.
She was on her way downtown to get married. As a matter of fact, she was waiting for my office to come by.
For 20 years, I've been trying to trap Lionel.
Think of how this will sound in front of a jury, Crosby, if they're still awake. 20 years she waits to snag a man, and when she finally gets him cornered, you splash mud on her and he jilts her.
Oh, I'm a beast.
Speaking of beasts, let's get back to my client. 20 long years she waited for Lionel.
Well, where was he all that time?
He was in bed with a very bad haircut. He got mixed up in a clip joint. And now, because of you, this girl will have to spend the rest of her life sitting at home twiddling her thumbs. And there's nothing more disgusting than a pair of twiddle thumbs.
Hold on.
I'd like to see Skitch Henderson play the piano with twiddle thumbs. I'd like to see a Tabby play that way. Come to think of it, I'd like to see a Tabby. He owes me 20 smackers.
20 smackers. Well, now, that's a nice round figure, and that's just what I'm going to give you.
And that's just what I'm going to take.
Oh, no, you won't. You said we'd hook Crosby for plenty.
That's the trouble with you girls around Hollywood, framing celebrities. Splashing mud on your dress, hiring a cheap, shyster lawyer. Now go before I set the dogs on you. But before you go, I want to say one thing to you. You owe me 85 cents for the mud.
Groucho Marx with Bing Crosby and the sketch called Attorney at Law. Well, now we return to the world of opera. I mentioned before that I would play you a track of one of the most distinguished of the pupils of Marcella Sembrich. And in a way, I'm pushing it a bit to call her her pupil because she only took a few lessons from her. But that did happen. Alma Gluck was born in 1884 and died in 1938, so she had a comparatively short life. And she was born in Romania, just like her famous teacher. She wasn't born in America, but she turned up in the United States when she was just 6 years old, so she was already there in 1890. You know, one thinks of all these singers who recorded in the first decade of the century as being of the same age, but of course, Alma Gluck was a good 25 years younger than Marcella Sembrich. And she'd never planned to be an opera singer. She was just an ordinary stenographer, and she married a man called Mr. Gluck. But then her friends noticed that she could sing very well, and she took some lessons with a famous person called Alberto Buzzipeccia, who was famous for writing songs as well as being a vocal teacher, rather in the way that the famous Tosti was. Well, one day, she was invited to a party at his house, and he was very well connected, because at the party, there were people like the Toscaninis and Pasquale Amato, the great baritone. Well, the result was, in no time at all, she was signed up to sing at the Metropolitan Opera House. She didn't actually sing there till a couple of years later, but that's what she did in the end. And she spent 4 years singing at the Metropolitan Opera. But despite her great gift for learning roles and indeed languages pretty quickly. She was never really happy acting on stage, and very soon she decided that what she needed to do was to make records and to give concerts, where she was much more at home and much more at ease, rather than dressing up in costumes and acting. Meanwhile, her marriage to Mr. Gluck gradually fell apart because their lives were sort of so different to each other, and instead she was wooed by a young Russian violinist called Ephraim Zimbalist. Some of you who watch television may remember a series in the 60s called 77 Sunset Strip, in which there was a middle-aged man, very good-looking, with a suntan and everything, and his name was Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., and he indeed was the son of this what became married couple. Zimbalist and Gluck married in 1914, and they embarked on quite a few concerts together. Zimbalist indeed arranged various folk songs so that they could play them together. Now, Gluck started recording for Victor, and her records included lots of more popular stuff, not necessarily opera at all, and she sold millions and millions and millions of records indeed. One of her records was one of their first million sellers. And just like Marcella Sembrich had done before, Gluck also got the chance to record with the great Caruso. So you have this wonderful singer. She probably didn't have the technical accomplishments of Marcella Sembrich, whom, by the way, she took some lessons from when they were both in Berlin. And she also studied with Jean de Reschke, the great 19th century tenor, who was by this time retired and in not particularly good health, but she learned a couple of roles studying with him. Her voice began to lose its upper range by, shall we say, 1917 and 1918. People talk about that. And her voice was always somewhat dark, and you can imagine her being almost a mezzo in some respect, but her top range on record is wonderful. And as I said, if she lacked some of the technical ability that Marcella Sembrich had, what she did have was that her voice, and you can't learn this, had a particular emotional pull in it, a tear-jerking quality, if you will, and it just draws you to her singing. It's wonderful. So I'm going to give you one of her great operatic recordings. This one is called A non credea mirarti, and it was recorded, I'm just looking for the date here, in 1911. So she was only, what was she, 26, 27 when she recorded this. And this is from Bellini's opera La Sonnambula. And you really can't imagine it being sung much better than this. So, ladies and gentlemen, Alma Gluck. E si in tu vio Alma Gluck, who, by the way, was born with the name Reba Fearson, and that was her original name. I met her great-nephew some years later, and he is called Barney, and he tells me that the family tradition says that she and her sister used to rush around New York and other towns, having lots and lots of fun, going shopping, laughing, joking together. She sounds like a wonderful person that you'd like to have known. Another person who you would also have liked to have known, a very different sort of person, a very different sort of singer, without a voice that would change the world, but somehow who made herself into a great jazz singer. And she was born Mildred Rinker. And she was the sister of somebody called Alton, or Alton Rinker. Al Rinker had a friend called Bing Crosby, and they formed a group together, which later became the Rhythm Boys. And Mildred, it was, although no older than the boys, got her break a little bit in Los Angeles before they did. And when they moved from Spokane, Washington, to Los Angeles, she was the one who introduced them to the right places and the right clubs and started their career. Mildred Bailey, I'm told, was part Native American. So although she is always regarded as a white singer, she was of mixed race. There may be even more mixed up. I don't know. I've heard all sorts of tales about what she was in terms of racial background. Not that it matters a bit, really. It's her singing which matters. And she never really made it because she was, as they say on one of these record covers, too commercial to be really accepted by the jazz community, and too jazzy to really be accepted by the pop fans of its day. She was too sophisticated for them. I've also heard that she was an influence upon the very early young Billie Holiday. None of this I'm sure about, but I do know that she had a very, very salty personality who could be really amusing, with a great sense of humour one second. She could fly into a rage the next and then be nice as pie the third. She was that sort of person. But everybody who knew her for any length of time apparently loved her. Speaking of love, she ended up married to a gentleman called Red Norvo, who did a lot of great recordings with her. She also recorded with Teddy Wilson, as did Billie Holiday later. But I'm going to play you one of the wonderful arrangements written for her, I assume, by Red Norvo himself. It was certainly his orchestra. This is a song which nobody does very much, and I love it. When they do it at all these days, it's modern jazz musicians who just like the chord sequence and throw away the tune. It's a song called, and they do it too fast as well, it's a lovely sentimental song, and it's even got a rather nice lyric. It's called Old Folks, and as you'll hear, the lyric is about a little old man who lives wherever this songwriter lives. Old Folks by Robertson and Hill was recorded on the 14th of September 1938, and I think shows Mildred Bailey at her best. And please don't ignore the arrangement. The arrangement of the orchestra is just wonderful. I still haven't worked out quite what chords are being used, but they're just right, and they just give it that extra little flip of interest, which makes this one of my favourite tracks of hers. So, Mildred Bailey, ladies and gentlemen, singing Old Folk.
Old folks, did he fight for the blues? taking a little nip or two. Every Friday, he'll go fishing way down on Buzzard Lake. But he only hooks a perch or two, a whale got away. So we warm up the steak. Oh, someday there'll be no more old folks. What a lonely old town this will be. Children's voices at play will be still for a day, the day that they take old folks away.
Mildred Bailey, I think, and I know I'm not alone in this, I think she's one of the great definitive jazz singers. Mildred Bailey. Now, I did say I was going to try and find out something about the Peerless Orchestra, and I just did a Google on them. And I'm afraid there's not much about them, apart from some tracks that you can download of them. There was, however, a postcard somewhere, a photograph on the back of a postcard, and indeed they seem to be an all-white orchestra. Interesting picture, by the way, because they're photographed against a backdrop, probably one of those fire curtains in a theatre, and it's got lots and lots of adverts on it for things like the local dentist and so forth. Things were different 100 years ago. Anyway, that's the Peerless Orchestra. As I said, they are an all-white affair and with the usual patronising attitude towards black people, which was normal at the time. They probably didn't mean any harm by it, but there it is. Right, now we come to the point where normally I now sing one of my own songs. And this time I'm going to do something a bit more dangerous for myself. We included a track of Duke Ellington this time, and as you will know, many of you, he, in 1940, found a sort of writing partner called Billy Strayhorn, who wrote, indeed, his later theme tune called Take the A-Train. And when Billy Strayhorn died prematurely in the 60s, they made a wonderful CD of, or LP it would have been at the time, of Billy Strayhorn's tunes called And His Mother Called Him Bill. One of the tunes on that was a piece of music which a legend has it that they found on a piece of paper after he died, and on the back of this bit of paper was written blood count, because this was a medical report, because I think Billy Strayhorn died of leukemia or something of that nature. And therefore the tune is known as Blood Count. It's a fantastic recording on the LP with a wonderful solo by Johnny Hodges, but that's outside the remit for my podcast because it's after the 78 RPM era. However, I do perform this myself. I've done a sort of piano arrangement, and I'm going to play you my piano arrangement of this tune. I'm no jazz pianist. I do my best, but hey, why not have a go? This is my version of Billy Strayhorn's Blood Count, and I hope you'll enjoy it. And I hope also that you've enjoyed the program. It will tell your friends about it, and we'll be back here next time. As you know, there are lots of programs that you can download now. You can go back to the first one over a year ago. So I hope you keep coming along, telling your friends, and let's spread this wonderful music that's on 78 all around the world. Till the next time then, all the best, and au revoir.